Entering trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And it is Saturday once again, friends. The 11th of January in the glorious future year of 2025. And we'll start with just the teeny weeniest bit of a mail call here. Ding, 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 mail call, ding, 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 ding. I should do that as a sound effect I can trigger by pressing a button like MNW has. Anyway, but got a little piece of mail from Tobe. A handsel, a thing to start the new year with. It's half envelope and half collage, consisting of things like Chinese restaurant menus and white monkey holding peach balm labels and something with the Quaker Oats man, or possibly William Penn, or possibly Benjamin Franklin and Hillary Clinton on it? I really don't understand, but it's art. Anyway, when it arrived, it was open. The seal on the back had been damaged or torn off or something in transit, but I knew that this was not a problem because he'd already sent me an email saying that there wasn't anything in it, that I didn't need to open it. But yes, so a Hansel from Tobe. And I'm planning on sending out some mail on Monday. The ice is melting away here, so folks who are my Patreon supporters in particular will be getting some of the new stickers that I had made, the ones with the crack back. Otherwise, in design terms, they're very similar to the previous stickers, but I like the crack back feature. It makes them much quicker to apply. Which isn't so much of a deal when you're using them, for example, on letters or something. It's a much bigger deal if you're, I don't know, defacing bus stop ads. What else is there to say about that? Well, after my last broadcast, I got a phone call from an unhappy listener who said, if the 21st century starts on the 1st of January 2001, how can you say at the beginning of 2025 that the first quarter of the 21st century is exhausted? Well, there's lots of answers that I could give to that. Of course, I could just say, oh, I screwed up, don't worry about it. But actually, I wanted to talk for a moment about the metaphenomenon of recurrent phenomena. Because, you see, time is defined by recurrent phenomena, things which happen again and again, and specifically by periodically recurrent phenomena. We can distinguish between two classes of periodically recurrent phenomena and aperiodically recurrent phenomena. But we can only do it by making comparisons. In other words, if I tell you that there's a transition between two states of the neutral cesium atom, you say, okay, what does that mean to me? But if it so happens that ever so many millions of those transitions happen in the time that it takes for the pendulum at the clock at a proper, properly adjusted clock at an astronomical observatory to make one swing forward and then back, and that every time that pendulum swings forward and then back, we count very close to the same number of transitions of that fine state in the neutral cesium atom, then we learn something interesting, namely that the pendulum and the cesium atom transition are both periodically recurrent phenomena. In other words, the fact that something happens repeatedly There's really no good way to say, observing one kind of phenomenon in isolation, that it is periodically recurrent. You can only say that it's recurrent. You have to compare it with another phenomenon. And the likelihood of a coincidence that irregularly recurrent phenomena would line up so neatly time after time after time is so small that eventually you develop a confidence that these phenomena are indeed truly recurrent. And Isaac Asimov had a story about this because, okay, so in terms of periodically recurrent phenomena which we observe in nature, the big ones, of course, are the cycle of the day, the cycle of the month, and the cycle of the year. Somewhat less obvious ones would be the sunspot cycle, and the which is roughly 11 years, and the 18-year Saros, or lunar cycle. That's the, essentially, that's the interval between when full moons fall on the same solar days of the year. I have no idea what's going on in comm right now. But, so, you know, the sun, we perceive it, as Bucky Fuller says, this is an inadequate perception, but we perceive it to arise in the east, travel overhead, and set in the west. Over the course of the year, we observe it to move from north to south, and then back north again, right? We observe the moon go from new to full to new again, and it's rising to go from in tune with the sun to opposed to the sun to back to in time with the sun. Right? We observe all these things. If we look more closely, we observe the planets behaving similarly. So there's actually an Isaac Asimov story, which is really quite intriguing, about a planet and a civilization where they don't have these quite the same kind of periodically recurrent astronomical phenomena because they're in a very complex star system and night only falls at such extremely long intervals that the whole society is thrown into convulsions by it. And then David Gerald and Larry Niven took that basic premise and really ran with it. Wrote a story called The Flying Sorcerers. The title is just a pun on flying saucers. It doesn't have, well, I guess it has a little to do with the action of the book, but not a lot. Anyway, but in The Flying Sorcerers, you see, you have a whole culture of intelligent beings who have no concept of anything resembling science, because they live in such a complex star system that they've never discerned stable, repetitive patterns in nature. And the whole of science, of course, is based on discerning stable, repetitive patterns in nature. So they basically believe in various systems of magic, most of which don't work, but occasionally they sort of by accident do something that does work. Anyway, and so a traveler from the stars comes and is completely baffled and flabbergasted by what he encounters. I don't know, it's meant to be humorous, I suppose, but it's also a very interesting premise and an interesting story. So that's my science fiction recommendation for the day. Now, let's see, in addition to, as I said, I got some more Man and Atom stickers. Thinking about getting some more Luna Project stickers made. I've never had really successful and satisfactory ones. I'm still hunting about There's a place that does stickers printed on hologram foil, and that might work. I'm going to see, right? I'm going to see what I can get that I like. Anyway, I've also been busy with the badge press. So, as I mentioned, I've been making badges using a variety of U.S. and foreign postage stamps. The folks who sell the badge parts also have a couple of other options. One is magnet backs that could be used for refrigerator magnets or clothing magnets. Some people prefer not to put pins through their clothing, but you can, you know, give somebody a magnet and a keeper. What I'm currently using for keepers are just foreign coins made out of steel. But you give somebody a magnet and a keeper, and they can put the keeper on the back of the piece of clothing, the magnet on the front, and they hold together. Now, that wouldn't probably work with the refrigerator magnets that I got as samples when I bought the badge making kit, because they use those plastic magnets, which are kind of wimpy. But there's also an option for ceramic disc magnets. And I've mentioned this before, it's like $40 for 250 of those. And then the other option that the company has, which is magnetic, although that's not its main purpose, is a bottle opener back. And I managed to get them to send me a couple of samples of those. And it's a much thicker, heavier steel with a slot cut in it for opening bottles, but it's also got a little rare earth magnet embedded in it, so you can put it on your refrigerator or whatever. Anyway, and it's $86 for 250 of those. And I'm thinking about getting some of each if I have some way of disposing of them for profit. Right. I want to be able to sell some of this stuff. Now, one place to do that would be at conventions. I'm seriously looking at the possibility of online marketplaces. Big problem with that is, for a long time, the go-to for selling random stuff was eBay, but they've made it very hostile for anybody who's not a business seller. And then for handicrafts in particular, for a long time, you had, well, I mean, several years, a long time in internet time. Swatch internet time. You had Etsy, but Etsy has done a lot of really obnoxious things lately. They've piled a bunch of fees that they didn't have before, but they've also made it so it's less a marketplace for handicrafts and more a marketplace for drop shipped stuff from China and print on demand junk and that sort of thing, which is exactly the opposite of what I'm interested in. So, you know, basically, Etsy is so flooded with these items that I don't see any point of opening an Etsy account, putting my stuff up on Etsy for, in the hope that people who are searching at random for on Etsy and search for space items or nuclear energy items or what have you would just stumble across it and say, oh, that's nifty, I want one of those, right? That's the response that I want, and I just don't think that I'm going to get it on Etsy as it currently exists. Anyway, so there are a few things out there which are trying sort of to take the place of Etsy as a handicraft marketplace. And I don't know if any of them is really all that useful. One of them that certainly interests me just calls itself Artisan Co-op. The biggest problem with it at present is simply that it expects you to buy in, right? Which is not unreasonable for a co-op, but, you know, it'd be like $100. Well, the artisan, there's two tiers, the artisan membership and the supporter membership. And you can open a store with the supporter level membership. The thing being that even a supporter level membership is $100, and I just wonder how long it would take to make that back. I have doubts. Now, mind you, I've just gone and made another batch of the coin cards that I make. Those of you who are my Patreon supporters at the $5 a month level or above will have received one, probably. I still have at least one to mail out. But the coin cards, so I take a mat board and I use a laser cutter to cut it into little rectangular cards with a circular cutout, and then into the circular cutout goes a Greek 10 drachma coin, which has got an atomic symbol on one side and an imaginary portrait of Democritus, the philosopher who is the father of the atomic theory, that goes on the other side. And then there's a postage stamp which goes on it, either one of the U.S. 3-cent Atoms for Peace stamps, the very iconic two hemispheres Atoms for Peace stamps, or the Canadian 5-cent Douglas Point Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy stamp from the mid-60s, because I recently got some of those. So the most recent batch of coin cards I've made up are Canadian content. CanCon! But actually, I also made up some Christmas coin cards, because I was humming to myself, there's a Christmas carol. I think the Weavers did it anyway. It's really a wassailing song, but a soul cake, please good mistress, a soul cake. Anyway, and it says at one point, if you haven't got a penny, a halfpenny will do. Anyway, and I realized, well, I could make some cards up and put that verse on them, and then put a Christmas stamp or something on them, and put a British halfpenny coin in there. And so I went to the coin dealer, and I rummaged through the bins, and I got myself some old-style halfpenny coins, the big ones, not the new little halfpenny coins, which have themselves been demonetized. I made up a few samples. Of course, I always get my idea for a bright idea for a nifty Christmas thing immediately after Christmas, when it's too late to do anything about it. But at least I have it for next year. Partly this comes about because I bought a crate full of office supplies in an estate sale, and there turned out to be a box of printable Christmas cards, basically. Anyway, they got foil embossing on, and they say season's greetings, but the inside is blank, and they're laid out so you could feed them through a printer. And so I did up that as the mailer for them. And so I'll have that for next year, and it might be a merchandise item which I could sell to people wanting Christmas stuff. It doesn't have anything to do with atomic energy or space travel or anything else. It's just something that I could potentially sell to get a little income, because that's always a concern for me. PA2 in comms says that there's a good version of that carol done by Sting. Let's see, what else is there to talk about? Well, of course, the first two terrorist attacks in America in the new year were both using cars as the weapon. And, of course, there was a major terrorist attack just before Christmas in Germany using a car as the weapon. And I was driving home on Wednesday, just before the winter weather set in, and off to the side of the road, there was a car on fire. I don't believe it was a battery electric car. I believe it was an ordinary gasoline car. The flames were all coming out of the engine compartment, but it was blazing merrily. My God. One of the doors was open, so I assume that the people inside escaped with their lives. But, of course, for the American, for the average American, the typical American living in the typical American city, a car, well, if you don't have a car, you don't have a life. You can't get to your job, you can't get to the shopping and buy food, you can't do anything. Your life, your livelihood depends on having a car. And the result, of course, is that most Americans, they can't see beyond that. They can't imagine living without a car. It's the way that fish, you know, we always say fish don't perceive the water they swim in, that the average American, the typical American, is so inured to the car-oriented environment that it's difficult to even envision living without a car. A car is like an extension of the self. It's how you get to places. It's how you do things. It is inevitable. There's no choice involved, which is why Americans will typically scream like bloody murder when anybody talks about transit projects or bike lanes or anything, and they don't say anything about the tens of thousands of people a year who are killed in car wrecks. They don't say anything about the billions and billions of dollars spent on car-oriented infrastructure. They don't say anything about, other than occasionally complaining about traffic delays due to road construction, essentially. Now, the fact that you could have a lot of rail transit for what even a single new freeway interchange costs goes right over people's heads because they can't imagine a life that the car isn't integrated to in every way, in every aspect, practically in every moment. People eat in their cars, they have sex in their cars. All right? The car is mother, the car is father. And I'm not talking about that sitcom, My Mother, the Car, which certainly had one of the weirdest premises, although there were a lot of situation comedies in the 1960s with truly bizarre premises. It's, in fact, one of the things that I really like when I go to Europe is spending 2 months or so at a time without a car. In fact, I try to avoid even getting into a car if I possibly can, although that's not always feasible. In fact, mostly I even avoid buses. You know, basically, if it's on rails, I like it. I realize that's a very strange snobbishness, but it's true. Rail transit, yeah, give it to me, baby. Buses are clattery and noisy and shaky, blah. Give me a streetcar, give me a subway, you know, give me a train. All those things, I like them. Again, that's just me. I don't demand that you conform to all aspects of my ideology, although clearly my ideology is superior to anything that's, you know, widely accepted these days and being made available in the so-called marketplace of ideas. Of course, you know, part of my aversion to cars is simply having driven probably an average of 400 kilometers a week since I was 16 years old. That's probably right. Anyway, I've never been involved in an injury accident. That's about the best thing that I can say from my experience with cars. I've never been involved with an injury accident. Jay LaMoth is very pleased with the recently installed light rail system. And I'm glad to hear it. Let's see. Of course, again, I'm not going to keep harping on the unsatisfactory nature of the mass market ideologies, but seriously, you've got somebody who is apparently going to become the next president of the United States who thinks that he can tax Canada out of existence and declare war on Denmark to force them to hand Greenland over to the United States, and a great deal of other things. Now, I'm not fixated on what the guy says, but it certainly disturbs me because he might actually have the power to do some of these things, which would obviously be bad. In fact, it's so obviously bad that no one wants to talk about how bad it is. You know, I listened to a piece of NPR, National Public Radio reporter Franco Ordonez, who'd been in this miserable, by the description of it, press conference-like thing, And at no point did he ever say, I was appalled, I was disgusted, I felt sick. Whereas me, myself, listening to what he was describing made me want to be sick. The thought of actually being trapped in a room for an hour, I would have vomited or at least fled the room. But the mass media have apparently gotten to the point where they desperately want to treat all this as normal. And nobody's willing to step back and say, hey guys, this is not normal, this is not okay. And treating it as normal and okay, of course, makes it more powerful. Gives the people who do these things more power. And I don't like that. Because, I mean, to me, what it sounds like is if a chimpanzee, STF or Kuma can tell you all about chimpanzees. If a chimpanzee could talk and had gone to grade school geography class, this is how the chimpanzee would talk. And that's exactly what I don't want. You know, people talk about the hind brain, the lizard brain, whatever. That's not so bad, okay? And the forebrain, the human cognitive empathic faculties, those aren't so bad. But the bit just behind that forebrain, the ape brain, that's where the really nasty stuff is. That's where the, oh, that guy has something I want, I'm going to kill him and take it. That's where that lives. Is not in the lizard brain, it's in the ape brain, which is just always lurking just behind the higher cognitive faculties. That's what you have to be careful about. Okay? I want to emphasize that the, you know, primordial instincts like mate, eat, you know, those aren't so bad. They keep you alive, basically. That's what they're for. You know, lizards, they're pretty good at staying alive. Although, you know, not having a tail that can be detached is always a disadvantage when the lizard brain comes into play. But, you know, and your higher faculties are great as long as they're not hijacked by the ape brain that's always lurking right behind them. And so I want to encourage you. I want to encourage you to think about what, you know, because the thing is that the higher faculties are the way that we do things like space travel and atomic energy, but they're not the, typically, the higher faculties aren't where the motivations come from. And that's sort of the problem, because we use those higher faculties, which are capable of so much, we use them in ways and for reasons and based on motives that we have to examine very closely if we're not going to destroy ourselves utterly, because we now have the ability to do that. Again, I don't like to talk about fear. I don't like to talk about despair. I don't like to talk about death. I don't like to talk about destruction. That's not my bailiwick. But I want to point out that the higher faculties and what they enable us to do are not necessarily self-motivating. Sure, there is the strong desire for scientific knowledge, right, which is a beautiful thing, but even most scientists aren't purely motivated by that. And it's not sufficient to build a whole society around. So we have to pick and choose what kind of motivations we are going to allow to drive the higher faculties. Anyway, I encourage you to write me a letter. Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. If you would like to support these broadcasts and aren't comfortable with mailing wads of cash or checks or postal orders made out to C.D. Carson to that same address, you can support me by PayPal, paypal.me/PrometheusLives. You can make a recurring contribution, patreon.com/man_and_atom. And, of course, I will like to send you some stuff if you do that.